Chapter 7. Bed. For me, it crawled toward Kurtz exclusively. But when the steam pipes started leaking, we crawled very slow. The reaches opened before us and closed behind, as if the forest had stepped leisurely across the water to bar the way for our return. We penetrated deeper and deeper into the heart of darkness. It was very quiet there. At night, sometimes the roll of drums behind the curtain of trees would run up the river and remain sustained faintly, as if hovering in the air high over our heads, till the first break of day. Whether it meant war, peace, or prayer, we could not tell. The dawns were heralded by the descent of a chill stillness. The woodcutters slept, their fires burned low. The snapping of a twig would make you start. We were wanderers on a prehistoric earth, on an earth that wore the aspect of an unknown planet. We could have fancied ourselves the first of men taking possession of an accursed inheritance, to be subdued at the cost of profound anguish and of excessive toil. But suddenly, as we struggled round a bend, there would be a glimpse of rush walls, of peaked grass roofs, a burst of yells, a whirl of black limbs, a mass of hands clapping, of feet stamping, of bodies swaying, of eyes rolling, under the droop of heavy and motionless foliage. The steamer toiled along slowly on the edge of a black and incomprehensible frenzy. The prehistoric man was cursing us, praying to us, welcoming us, who could tell? We were cut off from the comprehension of our surroundings. We glided past like phantoms, wondering and secretly appalled, as sane men would be before an enthusiastic outbreak in a madhouse. We could not understand, because we were too far, and could not remember, because we were traveling in the night of first ages, of those ages that are gone, leaving hardly a sign and no memories. The earth seemed unearthly. We are accustomed to look upon the shackled form of a conquered monster, but there you could look at a thing monstrous and free. It was unearthly, and the men were they were not inhuman. Well, you know, that was the worst of it, this suspicion of their not being inhuman. It would come slowly to one. They howled, and leaped, and spun, and made horrid faces. But what thrilled you was just the thought of their humanity like yours, the thought of your remote kinship with this wild and paw-sionate uproar. Ugly. Yes, it was ugly enough. But if you were man enough, you would admit to yourself that there was in you just the faintest trace of a response to the terrible frankness of that noise, a dim suspicion of there being a meaning in it which you so remote from the night of first ages, could comprehend. And why not? The mind of man is capable of anything, because everything is in it, all the past as well as all the future. What was there after all? Joy, fear, sorrow, devotion, valor, rage, who can tell, but truth stripped of its cloak of time. Let the fool gape and shudder, the man knows, and can look on without a wink. But he must at least be as much of a man as he's on the shore. He must meet that truth with his own true stuff, with his own inborn strength. Principles? Principles won't do. Aquacite ions, clothes, pretty rags that would fly off at the first good shake. No, you want a deliberate belief. An appeal to me in this fiendish row, is there? Very well, I hear, I admit, but I have a voice too, and for good or evil mine is the speech that cannot be silenced. Of course, a fool, what with sheer fright and fine scent immense, is always safe. Who's that grunting? You wonder I didn't go ashore for a howl and a dance? Well, no, I didn't. Fine sentiments, you say? Fine scent immense, be hanged. I had no time. I had to mess about with white lead, and strips of woolen blanket helping, to put bandages on those leaky steam pipes, I tell you. I had to watch the steering, and circumvent those snags, and get the tin pot along by hook or by crook. There was surface truth enough in these things to save a wiser man. And between whiles I had to look after the savage who was fireman. He was an improved specimen. He could fire up a vertical boiler. He was there below me, and, upon my word, to look at him was as edifying as seeing a dog in a parody of breeches and a feather hat, walking on his hind legs. A few months of training had done for that really fine chap. He squinted at the steam gauge and at the water gauge with an evident effort of intrepidity, and he had filed teeth too, the poor devil, and the wool of his pate shaved in two queer patterns, and three ornamental scars on each of his cheeks. He ought to have been clapping his hands and stamping his feet on the bank, instead of which he was hard at work, a thrall to strange witchcraft, full of improving knowledge. He was useful, because he had been instructed. And what he knew was this, that should the water in that transparent thing disappear, the evil spirit inside the boiler would get angry through the greatness of his thirst, and take a terrible vengeance. So he sweated and fired up, and watched the glass fearfully with an impromptu charm, made of rags, tied to his arm, and a piece of polished bone, as big as a watch, stuck flatways through his lower lip, while the wooded banks slipped past us slowly, the short noise was left behind, the interminable miles of silence, and we crept on, towards Kurtz. But the snags were thick, the water was treacherous and shallow, the boiler seemed indeed to have a sulky devil in it, and thus neither that fireman nor I had any time to peer into our creepy thoughts. Some 50 miles below the inner station we came upon a hut of reeds, an inclined and melancholy pole, with the unrecognizable tatters of what had been a flag of some sort flying from it, and a neatly stacked wood pile. This was unexpected. We came to the bank, and on the stack of firewood found a flat piece of board with some faded pencil writing on it. When deciphered, it said, "Wood for you. Hurry up. Approach cautiously." Apostrophe there was a signature, but it was illegible, not Kurtz, a much longer word. Hurry up. Where? Up the river? Approach cautiously. Apostrophe we had not done so. But the warning could not have been meant for the place, where it could be only found after approach. Something was wrong above. But what and how much? That was the question. We commented adversely upon the imbecility of that telegraphic style. The bush around said nothing, and would not let us look very far either. A torn curtain of red twill hung in the doorway of the hut, and flapped sadly in our faces. The dwelling was dismantled, but we could see a white man had lived there not very long ago. There remained a rude table, a plank on two posts. A heap of rubbish reposed in a dark corner, and by the door I picked up a book. It had lost its covers, and the pages had been thumbed into a state of extremely dirty softness. But the back had been lovingly stitched afresh with white cotton thread, which looked clean yet. It was an extraordinary find. Its title was, "An Inquiry into Some Points of Seamanship, apostrophe by a man tower, Tosin some such name master in His Majesty's Navy." The matter looked dreary reading enough, with illustrative diagrams and repulsive tables of figures, and the copy was 60 years old. I handled this amazing antiquity with the greatest possible tenderness, lest it should dissolve in my hands. Within, Tosin or Toser was inquiring earnestly into the breaking strain of ship's chains and tackle, and other such matters. Not a very enthralling book, but at the first glance you could see there a singleness of intention, an honest concern for the right way of going to work, which made these humble pages, thought out so many years ago, luminous with another than a professional light. The simple old sailor, with his talk of chains and purchases, made me forget the jungle and the pilgrims in a delicious sensation of having come upon something unmistakably real. Such a book being there was wonderful enough, but still more astounding were the notes penciled in the margin, and plainly referring to the text. I couldn't believe my eyes. They were in cipher. Yes, it looked like cipher. Fancy a man lugging with him a book of that description into this nowhere, and studying it and making notes in cipher at that. It was an extravagant mystery. I had been dimly aware for some time of a worrying noise, and when I lifted my eyes I saw the woodpile was gone, and the manager, aided by all the pilgrims, was shouting at me from the riverside. I slipped the book into my pocket. I assure you, to leave off reading was like tearing myself away from the shelter of an old and solid friendship. I started the lame engine ahead. It must be this miserable traitor, this intruder, apostrophe exclaimed the manager, looking back malevolently at the place we had left. He must be English, apostrophe I said. It will not save him from getting into trouble, if he is not careful, apostrophe muttered the manager darkly. I observed with assumed innocence, that no man was safe from trouble in this world. The current was more rapid now, the steamer seemed at her last gasp, the stern wheel flopped languidly, and I caught myself listening on tiptoe for the next beat of the float, for in sober truth I expected the wretched thing to give up every moment. It was like watching the last flickers of a life. But still we crawled. Sometimes I would pick out a tree a little way ahead, to measure our progress towards Kurt's by, but I lost it invariably before we got abreast. To keep the eye so long on one thing was too much for human patience. The manager displayed a beautiful resignation. I fretted and fumed, and took to arguing with myself, whether or no I would talk openly with Kurtz. But before I could come to any conclusion it occurred to me that my speech or my silence, indeed any action of mine, would be a mere futility. What did it matter what anyone knew or ignored? What did it matter who was manager? One gets sometimes such a flash of insight. The essentials of this affair lay deep under the surface, beyond my reach, and beyond my power of meddling. Towards the evening of the second day we judged ourselves about 8 miles from Kurtz's station. I wanted to push on, but the manager looked grave, and told me the navigation up there was so dangerous, that it would be advisable, the sun being very low already, to wait where we were till next morning. Moreover, he pointed out that, if the warning to approach cautiously were to be followed, we must approach in daylight not at dusk, or in the dark. This was sensible enough. 8 miles meant nearly 3 hours steaming for us, and I could also see suspicious ripples at the upper end of the reach. Nevertheless, I was annoyed beyond expression at the delay, and most unreasonably too, since one night more could not matter much after so many months. As we had plenty of wood, and caution was the word, I brought up in the middle of the stream. The reach was narrow, straight, with high sides like a railway cutting. The dusk came gliding into it long before the sun had set. The current ran smooth and swift, but a dumb immobility sat on the banks. The living trees, lashed together by the creepers and every living bush of the undergrowth, might have been changed into stone, even to the slenderest twig, to the lightest leaf. It was not sleep, it seemed unnatural, like a state of trance. Not the faintest sound of any kind could be heard. You looked on amazed, and began to suspect yourself of being deaf. Then the night came suddenly, and struck you blind as well. About 3 in the morning some large fish leaped, and the loud splash made me jump, as though a gun had been fired. When the sun rose there was a white fog, very warm and clammy, and more blinding than the night. It did not shift or drive. It was just there, standing all round you like something solid. At 8 or 9, perhaps, it lifted as a shutter lifts. We had a glimpse of the towering multitude of trees, of the immense matted jungle, with the blazing little ball of the sun hanging over it all perfectly still, and then the white shutter came down again, smoothly, as if sliding in greased grooves. I ordered the chain, which we had begun to heave in, to be paid out again. Before it stopped running with a muffled rattle, a cry, a very loud cry, as of infinite desolation, soared slowly in the opaque air. It ceased. A complaining clamor, modulated in savage discords, filled our ears. The sheer unexpectedness of it made my hair stir under my cap. I don't know how it struck the others. To me it seemed as though the mist itself had screamed. So suddenly, and apparently from all sides at once, did this tumultuous and mournful uproar arise. It culminated in a hurried outbreak of almost intolerably excessive shrieking, which stopped short, leaving us stiffened in a variety of silly attitudes, and obstinately listening to the nearly as appalling and excessive silence. Good God! What is the meaning? Apostrophe stammered at my elbow one of the pilgrims, a little fat man, with sandy hair and red whiskers, who wore side spring boots and pink pajamas tucked into his socks. Two others remained open-mouthed a whole minute, then dashed into the little cabin to rush out incontinently and stand darting scared glances with Winchesters at ready in their hands. What we could see was just the steamer we were on, her outlines blurred, as though she had been on the point of dissolving, and a misty strip of water, perhaps 2 feet broad, around her, and that was all. The rest of the world was nowhere, as far as our eyes and ears were concerned. Just nowhere. Gone, disappeared. Swept off without leaving a whisper or a shadow behind. I went forward, and ordered the chain to be hauled in short, so as to be ready to trip the anchor and move the steamboat at once if necessary. Will they attack? Apostrophe whispered an odd voice. We will all be butchered in this fog, apostrophe murmured another. The faces twitched with the strain, the hands trembled slightly, the eyes forgot to wink. It was very curious to see the contrast of expressions of the white men and of the black fellows of our crew, who were as much strangers to that part of the river as we, though their homes were only 800 miles away. The whites, of course greatly discomposed, had besides a curious look of being painfully shocked by such an outrageous row. The others had an alert, naturally interested expression, but their faces were essentially quiet, even those of the one or two who grinned as they hauled at the chain. Several exchanged short, grunting phrases, which seemed to settle the matter to their satisfaction. Their headman, a young, broad-chested black, severely draped in dark blue fringed cloths, with fierce nostrils and his hair all done up artfully in oily ringlets, stood near me. Aha! Apostrophe, I said, just for good fellowship's sake. Catch him, apostrophe, he snapped, with a bloodshot whitening of his eyes, and a flash of sharp teeth. Catch him. Give him to us. Apostrophe to you, eh? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked. What would you do with them? Apostrophe, eat him. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he said curtly, and, leaning his elbow on the rail, looked out into the fog in a dignified and profoundly pensive attitude. I would no doubt have been properly horrified, had it not occurred to me that he and his chaps must be very hungry, that they must have been growing increasingly hungry for at least this month past. They had been engaged for 6 months.
I don't think a single one of them had any clear idea of time, as we at the end of countless ages have. They still belonged to the beginnings of time, but no inherited experience to teach them, as it were, and of course, as Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.